countrywide on RTE Radio 1. Sponsored by Caller Gas, celebrating 80 years, bringing energy to Ireland's homes and businesses.
And how are you on this beautiful Saturday morning? Marty Morrissey here for Damien O'Reilly on this particular day. And what a week it's been in the beef world. Eventful doesn't even come close. Here's a look back.
We're protesting here till we get some resolve to this situation, because we can't go back home without some sort of a settlement done, because we're on the breadline at the present time.
What about the workers in there? What do you say about them?
Well, the workers in there, at least if they're laid off, they have social welfare to go back, and we haven't that to go back, and we're depending on this for a living, and if we don't, we'll stay not long for it to be closed down in a very short time, because everyone will be gone over.
Part of the resolution of this will have to recognise that breakdown in relationships and put in place structures into the future.
And today, the country's first producer organisation, which can negotiate price on behalf of farmers, was established. Irish Beef Producers is backed by the Beef Plan movement. It can now begin to negotiate with factories on behalf of farmers. As that happens, the Beef Plan has this evening been targeting distribution centres of some retailers, including at a Tesco warehouse in Ballymun.
The farmers are just trying to get to the end of this and support their families.
The meat industry said they would go into talks if he lifted the blockades.
It's hard to believe any of the head men anymore, so we'll be here for the long haul, so.
And if 3,000 meat factory workers have been laid off temporarily across the country?
They're not looking at the bigger picture. Rural Ireland has been letting off people through shops, pubs, schools for the last number of years. There's been thousands of jobs lost. We need to see that there is something positive there for farmers.
Their refusal to engage effectively closes down the entire industry, and I would appeal to, in particular my eye, to reflect on that matter and on the fact that direct engagement with their customers is a business imperative in any business.
Very worried about that, you know.
What are you doing today? Is there any work going on?
Just few hours, you know, for the clean, you know, like little bit, you know, that's it, you know. More than the half is not work, you know, like stay home, you know, but everyone have to pay everything, you know, the rent, the loans, insurance, you know, everything. They start the schools now, you know, the people's, you know, have a children, you know.
Loads of families now struggling about the money because no work, no money. They don't know how many days it will take.
It's frustrating for an employee that done nothing wrong. He's trying to make a living. He's going to be signing on for the foreseeable future. There was a few in today. There's some, you know, like myself, have been laid off today till further notice. We're waiting on a phone call over the weekend to see if they're back killing Monday. If they're not back killing Monday, we were told to sign.
Aldi said last night, keeping Irish meat products on the shelves is more difficult. All of the pork and beef products marked Irish are processed in the UK, and when stores open in the morning, signs will be up telling customers that the meat is Irish and remains quality assured by Bord Bia.
And as if by magic, it's an amazing programme, this countrywide programme. The last voice in that montage is here with us this morning, Fran McNulty, RTÉ's Agricultural and Consumer Affairs Correspondent. Good to see you, Fran.
You too, Marty.
Where are we at in this at 8:19 on a Saturday morning?
Well, the offices of the Department of Agriculture are opening up this morning because talks will be getting underway in around an hour's time. And it is really a breakthrough in many senses. We thought we were here earlier in the week. That wasn't the case. The talks broke down when the meat industry pulled out. Michael Creed took to the phones yesterday morning and really intensified efforts to get things going, and said to meat processors, said to the farming representative organisations, this can't continue, because the beef export market is a pretty important market for us. 90% of the beef produced in this island is exported, and those export contracts are being hit. There's reputational damage. There's problems getting meat into supermarkets. The time is now to sit down and talk. And so everybody listen to that, and in an hour's time, the ball will get rolling.
And what's the mood like within the farming community?
It's very mixed, Marty. Normally in a dispute like this, you can get a sense, because there's a broad leadership. The IFA are leading in one direction. The ICMSA are leading in another. This is so split up. If you go to one picket line, and I've been talking to farmers up and down the country all day yesterday, some are resolute saying, we're going nowhere unless we get, you know, a better price for our cattle. You go to another picket line, they say, look, you know, we need to start talking. It's interesting, if you talk to people on a one-to-one basis, they tell you a very different story to which they tell when they're standing in front of 20 or 30 people on the picket line. There's a lot of hard talk. Behind that, the reality is this. People are fed up on the picket line. They've been 3 weeks there. They can't get jobs done at home. They have cattle to sell themselves and they can't sell them. And the longer they sit there, the lower the price gets for them. They may go over the in-spec rules and they're going to get less for them. And then on top of that, there will be a glut of cattle. Yeah. And the reality of that in the market is that that will affect price. So therefore, really everybody wants to get this done, but they want something concrete out of it. They want a better price. They want a roadmap, a future for the industry.
And I'll ask you the same question, but in terms of factories, what's their attitude at the moment?
They have been taking a very hard line. In the middle of last week, the factories started to sit down with the protesters on a one-on-one basis. And news of this started to creep through that factory owners, managers were sitting down with the farmers saying, look, you know, what's it going to take to get five loads of beef out? What's it going to take to get some cattle in to kill? And started to do deals. That has come to the point now where as an industry as a whole, they know that these farmers aren't going anywhere. So they have to talk. And it will take a day or two over this weekend to figure out whether the meat processors are actually going to put something on the table which can help this.
What about the retailers and perhaps maybe the Aldi move on Friday?
The Aldi move on Friday it signifies one thing, that suppliers are going to do everything they can to make sure beef gets into stores. If they don't, the corporate world that exists, they will be fined if they're not in a position to supply stock. But for the supermarkets, there is a lot of criticism of the supermarkets from many of the farmers that you meet out on the protest. They're saying they should be in the talks. They won't be in the talks today. That's my understanding. And they're saying they have a major role to play in this, yet we're sitting down with the meat factories. And then what the meat factories say is, well, we need all these rules because the retailers want them. But the retailers aren't at the table.
But why are they not at the table?
They should be. When the talks convened the last time, there was a provision for them to be there. They weren't. And my understanding is they weren't contacted this week and asked to be around the table. That will be a sticking point this weekend and today. But if there is some mechanism put in place as to how they could become involved, but you have to remember one thing, and you can simplify this if you like, Marty, but there are very strict competition rules in this country. And if processors sit down with retailers and primary producers to discuss price, you have a problem straight away. That is, you know, so they can't fix price, but they should be able to discuss, well, you know, how can we improve price? What can we do to spread out a fairer share of the cake, if you like? That should be possible, and many would hope it will be possible this weekend.
3,000 people laid off temporarily during the week. It's really hitting home now.
It is. Now, you know, and to almost every picket I've been on over the last few weeks, the response to that will be, well, our jobs are under threat as well. And that is the reality. The poor price farmers are getting for their beef means their jobs are under threat. It's interesting to listen to one man in that montage you played in Longford speaking to Kieran Mullooly saying, they're okay, they'll go out and they'll get social welfare. It's not the case for all of them, Marty. You know, 70-80% of people working in those plants are foreign nationals. I don't know if you've ever been in a boning hall when it's in full production. It is tough work. It is a tough place to work. The money isn't great. But a lot of those workers who aren't here for very long won't get social welfare. They were crying in Waterford when I saw them after that meeting last week. It is a really rough place to be. And the concern is many of them who've come here to make money, make a better life for their children, will probably have to return. Not all of them, it has to be said.
Well, it's obviously a crucial day. It's a busy day. Are you optimistic? What do you feel?
I think optimism might be misplaced at this point. I think there is a mood to get something over the line. But what it will come down to is the farming organisations being able to walk out of Ag House in the early hours of tomorrow morning and know that they can go to the picket lines and say, we've delivered X, Y and Z for you. You will get more money for your cattle. There will be more transparency around how you're paid. There will be a better share of the profits, whatever it may be. And it is far from clear that these talks will be able to achieve that. And that could be the problem. But I think everybody hopes on all sides that some sense could come out of the weekend and people could get back to their normal lives next week.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Fran McNulty, RT's Agriculture and Consumer Affairs correspondent, for coming in this morning. Always nice to have a Longford man on the radio, by the way.
Well, it makes every programme better, Mary.
Absolutely, Fran. Well said. Anyway, thank you for coming in. Well, it's replay day today for the footballers of Dublin and Kerry. but there's many a worry in the hurling fraternity as well, with almost three quarters of the ash used for hurlies imported because of a disease called ash dieback. It's also a huge concern for commercial forestry owners who are now calling for a compensation scheme. Hannah Quinn Mulligan met with the Limerick and Tipperary woodland owners who outlined the gravity of the situation their members are now facing.
We had our first confirmation of ash dieback in Ireland in 2012, and that was in a site in Leitrim that was planted in 2009. So, you know, there were still trees being imported from mainland Europe, ash trees that were infected into Ireland. My name is Colm Walsh. I'm chairman there of the Limerick and Tipperary Woodland Owners, a voluntary forest owner producer group based in Limerick and Tipperary.
And we're here in a park in Croom, County Limerick, and there's an ash tree in front of us, and it looks perfectly healthy to me. But if it did have ash dieback, you know, what does ash dieback, the disease, look like?
So kind of typically now this time of the year, you know, trees should be in full flight. If this tree had ash dieback, you know, it might be looking a bit withered, a bit lethargic. A lot of the leaves might be already gone off it, and a bit of a black stain coming into it as well, further up along the leaf going onto the stalk.
How much have forest owners lost because of ash dieback?
A lot of the ash plantations never got a chance to reach maturity. A typical ash plantation, 40 to 45 years old, at Clearfell, should be worth somewhere in the region of 40,000 euros a hectare at Clearfell. And there's 20,000 hectares affected in Ireland, so there's potential loss there to forest owners of 800 million.
That's a huge amount of money.
It's a huge figure, yeah, it's a huge figure. And the other sad thing about this is this affects an awful lot of older people that maybe planted land that either family members maybe didn't feel like taking over the farm. It's a big step for someone to plant their farm. Farms have been farmed for generations. Farmers want to farm, right? And those people that planted were pioneers of an industry. And, you know, they have been kicked down the road so far and so hard in the last couple of years over this ash dieback issue. It's actually amazing how the Forest Service and the Minister have let this happen, let it get to this stage.
One of those pioneers was Mary McCormick from Tipperary, who planted ash in 1998.
I had my land rented after my husband died, and it wasn't economically viable, too many bills and etc. So I studied forestry and the forestry plan that was there, and I thought, this is for me. I planted 100 acres of sitka, and which was two-thirds of the plantation, and the rest of it was sycamore, but mainly ash.
And how did things go for you?
Things went very well the first years. We were thrilled with it, and my children were delighted, and we used to go walking in the evening with the dogs, and it was good. I was actually quite proud of it. 2016, we noticed that things weren't as they should be. I was devastated, and one of my boys was in Cork at the time, and he said, I'll come up this evening. And we sat here in this room, and he went through everything. He was very sympathetic. He said, you know, there isn't any compensation and there isn't this or that. I thought we'd salvage maybe half the crop, you know, do a very heavy thinning. But when they moved in to do it, the crop was really devastated. It was dying from the top and it was dying at the root. And when they cut out the timber, there was that pink stain down through it. At the time, we could only take out under 10 hectares, and that's what we did, and we replanted it straight away.
And were you compensated just for the 10?
No.
The issue of compensation for ash forestry owners was raised in an Oireachtas committee in July. This is what Minister Andrew Doyle had to say on the matter.
Firstly, let me say that I'm well aware of the impact of ash dieback on Ireland's ash plantations. When this disease first presented, we put it in the first place as an Exchequer-funded reconstitution scheme to restore affected forests. And since then, over 1,600 hectares have been restored at a cost of 4.4 million. However, when the scientific outlook changed and it became evident that this disease could not be eradicated, the scheme was suspended in April of 2018 in order that a comprehensive review could be undertaken. And I intend to be in a position to announce the full results of this review shortly.
I thought that day that he was making a speech, and I thought, this is it now. And I had my notebook with me to take notes of what he was saying. And he said, no, I'm afraid it has been halted again, and it's not ready. It's not quite ready. I don't know at what stage is that. Have they scrapped it? Has it been put in the bin? And are they starting all over again? And then I read on the agricultural papers and articles about the importance of planting trees, that it's the only thing that's really going to store carbon. And I am there with the remainder of my ash trees dying. Now, they're not storing. They'll start releasing carbon.
So what would you say to the minister regarding compensation for ash dieback?
I would say immediately, because the forestry companies will get their money. They get their payment, whether they're planting or whether they're clear felling or whatever. But it's the producer is the one that carries the can when something goes wrong.
Hannah Quinn Mulligan reporting there. Well, they tell us that the SME sector, that's the small and medium enterprises, is going to be the driver of the Irish economy. So what drives people to get a business on its feet? And what's the support system to help keep them standing? We have two businesswomen in studio this morning, along with a mentor from the local enterprise office in Carlow. Patrice Cooney from Oscar Wilde Water in Barsalee, County Tipperary. You're very welcome.
Thank you very much, Marty.
And Martina Woods from Harry's Dog Bakery in Monaghan. You're welcome as well.
Thank
Lovely
you,
Marty. To have you here with us. And also joining us is the head of enterprise in Carlow. That's Kieran Comerford. So you're very welcome as well, Kieran.
Thank you very much.
Let me start with you, Martina Woods, of Harry's Treats. Who is Harry? And what was the trouble with Harry?
Well, Harry is our first dog. We got him as a pup, and he had a lot of illness, physical sickness, ear infections, and we didn't know why. It turned out that it was, even though he was on a good food, he was. We were giving him the normal run-of-the-mill treats that you buy in supermarkets, and it was those that was affecting his stomach. So by vet's advice, no more treats. And when you have a dog like Harry, who's a Cocker Spaniel, who's absolutely nuts, you need a treat. So I'm a chef by trade, and I created, I did a course on nutrition for dogs. It was a veterinary course around in Monaghan. And I worked with a vet that's into natural ingredients and combined recipes that Harry didn't have to fight out of a system. And that's how it all came about.
And pancreas can be an issue with dogs, can't it?
Yeah, these weren't an issue. It wasn't for pancreatitis. This was more just for a sensitive stomach.
Right.
I do have some dogs that are on for pancreatitis. I can't promote them as a pancreatitis, but anybody that's on them is suitable for them. They're good for dogs that have allergies, skin problems, because there's nothing. I mean, the base of them is brown rice flour. Then it's carrots, oats, honey, sweet potato. We use Meridian peanut butter. There's no palm oil. There's no salt. So it's all completely natural.
I'm getting hungry.
You could have them yourself
this
if you want.
And I'm not here.
If you could give you a good set of teeth, you could have them yourself.
Listen, breakfast hasn't been served here yet. But they're beautifully packaged. So you just... Obviously, Harry loved these.
Yes.
And where did you go from there?
Well, it turned out there was a lot of people in the same position as myself, that they needed natural treats for their dogs. And I ended up making them for them, and then I started then going to little markets and had little white bags selling them. And it was only then in 2016, then through different conversations with people, that I took it then serious as a business. And through the Monaghan Leo, then I called into them. It was the first time that Eileen Connolly and Monaghan now had to deal with dog food.
Yeah.
They didn't know what to do with me, but they were brilliant. I did a start your own business course, and through other various courses, then it progressed from there, and then spent money on the packaging. And
well, the packaging is excellent now.
Yeah,
it's
I have very good.
The dog, never mind the human being owners, but it looks really, really well.
Thank you.
It looks appetising.
Yeah.
Let me introduce Patrice Cooney from Barsalee Bottling. Normally on radio, there is a dress code, by the way, here on Countrywide, and we don't normally allow people in with Tipperary jerseys on.
I just said I'd rub it in a little bit more just as the season goes
on. You're overstating it completely.
I know.
But anyway, we allowed you in. We allowed you
the
visa.
Thank you very much. I'm wearing it for luck today now. So.
Yes, because you're your club are in the minor county final.
That's right. They're a minor North final actually today. Our minors team are, so they're very excited about that, and I wish them all the best of luck today.
Excellent.
At 12 o'clock. Yeah.
Now, Bursley Bottling, how did that come about?
Bursley Bottling actually Limited was started back in 2018, but Bursley has a long history in bottling and producing water from pure from source. It has a beautiful well there, and we've been doing that since the 80s. So the well was closed by a conglomerate at the time back a couple of years ago, and the machinery was being sold off, and my husband was involved in that, Frank, and some guy came down from the west with the brand Oscar Wilde, and he was looking to buy some machinery, and my husband said to him, well, we've a gorgeous well here that's not doing much at the moment and bursting to be pumped. It has the capacity to do about 10,000 bottles an hour minimum, so it has great potential and a beautiful source. And they got together, and a few financial investors and a local politician, and they reopened the well and reopened the factory, and now we have 20 employees down there, and we're excited for the future. So while Oscar Wilde is definitely the premium brand of the plant, we have seen obviously with sustainability and the way the environment is going that there's a huge need at the moment for sustainable products rather than plastic, so to remove the single-use plastics from the market. So now we have coming on board, and that we're very thankful to the Enterprise Village for allowing us to showcase our new biodegradable bottle, which is bottled at source again in Bursley and blown. You can see the preforms here. This is the bottle.
Yeah, which is fantastic.
Which is fabulous.
This is biodegradable.
So it's a biodegradable and recyclable. So what we're saying is we're promoting recycle, but what we're saying is if it ends up in landfill or in a compostable or in an organic environment, it will biodegrade under 5 years. So that's the insurance policy with it.
Right, okay.
So basically the preforms are blown in Bursley and filled, and they come normally like clear plastic would, but it's infused at the preform stage with an additive that makes the plastic biodegradable. And that's how...
And considering that we're getting a little bit more conscious about the environment, I mean, biodegradable is the way forward. I mean,
biodegradable and carton, anything to replace single-use plastics is the way to go. So everyone's getting into the compostable and all the rest of it. So we saw that niche in the market. And really, while Oscar Wilde is a fabulous brand and it's a premium brand and the Marker Hotel love it and the Merion and everything like that, it doesn't have the volumes that we really need to sustain a factory like we have in Bursley and a well that has that capacity. So... we know that this might be our ticket. So
when
we're hoping this is just launching now in the last month.
Yeah.
And
she even uses GA lingo. Do you notice that could be our ticket?
Yeah.
On our Ireland football final replay. Yeah. Yeah, I like that. Yeah.
Thank you very much. Well, just by the way, down in the Enterprise Village next week, we'll be raffling a fully signed jersey, tip jersey. So if anyone wants to come into the Enterprise Village and sign up for that, we're more than welcome to see
them. You're a marketing guru. You're taking every opportunity. Well done, Patrice. That's why you're successful.
We'll see. Fingers crossed. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Keep Irish going, isn't that it? Buy Irish.
Kieran Comerford, who is the head of enterprise in Carlow County Council. Kieran, talk to me about the difficulties. Starting, these two ladies are fantastic, starting with their own business. But to go from an idea that you have in your head to becoming reality, like what they've done, it's a bit of a journey, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's a brave journey any entrepreneur takes. And like the local enterprise offices, which are 5 years old this year, were established within the local authority network to help people to be passionate about their story and guide them along the way. We have a team of experts, of business advisors, senior enterprise development officers who meet people on a daily basis who have the passion to want to do something for themselves and really should be supported. And it's our job really to firstly to signpost them to the various supports available from government, but secondly provide a variety of supports ourselves. Nationally, obviously, we're talking about the local enterprise village today. Tomorrow, Ireland's best young entrepreneur is on. We also have a number of supports around Brexit. So it's very much about, you know, creating supports that make sense to their story. And the first thing we always do is just listen to their story, listen to their challenges. And it's very much about them breaking that down into the supports that are available. And also, it's their journey at the end of the day. An entrepreneur, it's very much about their passion, their ambition. And it's our job really to help them realise that ambition. And so whether it's to have a small company and create a job for themselves, or whether it be have a large company and go over to Enterprise Ireland, it's fundamentally our focus is to constantly be customer focused and to really solve problems for them. And I think in these challenging times, like, they've great bravery, and anyone who decides to start their own business, great bravery, and they really deserve to be supported by our system.
Three bullet points, three pieces of advice you give. Somebody walks in, I walk into you, Kieran, and I have this idea of dog food, or I have bottling water in a well below in Bursley. What do you say to them?
I suppose the first thing we say is I always break it down to two things. So firstly, look at themselves and say, well, actually, as an individual, what do I bring to the table? Because sometimes we discount that. So they could have a wonderful career in sales or a wonderful, wonderful background in industry. The other thing is to understand their weaknesses from the point of view of what team they have to build around them. And obviously, we can support them from the point of view of mentors and programs and things like that. And the other thing is to connect with your customer. Like, a business isn't a business until you have customers who pay a bill. So it's really important that you validate it and talk to the market. So it's very much about looking at yourself, looking at your market opportunity, and also looking at the support system you have to build around you. And that's what we constantly build our supports around.
And Martina, what was the greatest difficulty you had starting? And what was the greatest satisfaction? What was the kick you got?
The feedback that I got from customers, you know. The treat's not for every dog, and I'm not knocking the product. I mean, there is treats out there that have fat, sugars, salts, additives, preservatives. And when a dog smells something, they smell it. And with these, they're smelling something completely different. But the feedback that I've got from an awful lot of people, and people that are buying them on a regular basis and buying them through the website, that just does your heart good. And the difficulties was... I am from Monaghan, not Cavan, and spending money was just, you know, when you see the price of packaging, you see, again, we're trying to go down the sustainability route as well. That scares me, you know. But you man up, you just bite the bullet and go for it. When you know that you have a good product, it's easier to go for it. And anybody that believes that they have something, go for it. It does your heart good now.
So 5 years' time, where do you want to be?
Oh, lying in the Bahamas. No, I'm going to...
Lie in the hinge. Okay. Way nicer.
She's a pragmatic chipper.
Oh, my God. It's unreal. But 5 years, I would love to see the product... At the moment, we stock into a lot of some veterinary practices and some dog groomers. Ideally, I'd love to see it more in veterinary practices, because this is where it needs to be. Then I'd love to see it definitely going to the European route and upscaling and bringing Harry's Dog Bakery further afield.
To a different level.
Yeah.
And you started, what year was it?
We only started in 2018, really, with Bursley Battling Limited.
But, and you now have 20 people employed?
Yeah, well, you see, they were a combination of old engineers who had worked previously under the previous management. So I suppose the vision for us is to continue as we're going. We know our well is an amazing source, so to see this product back in action and the rebirth of a factory in rural Ireland is massive to us and to Bursley and to the surrounding areas. And it's a small community with a big heart, but we, you know, rural Ireland needs industrial jobs as well as the farming jobs and as well as the other jobs. So to see that progress with the Global Hydrate recyclable and sustainable packaging that we have with our water, that's where we would love to see. And to make a change, this is the first Irish offering at the moment on the market. And I mean, to be able to compete with the import, you know, it's huge, really. You know, why would you bring it in from England if you have it here? Support the Irish economy, support the Irish jobs, and I encourage people to look for Global Hydrate or look for, you know, those kind of products that are on the shelves, you know. And yeah, that's what it is, I think.
Well, absolutely. We wish you well.
Yeah.
And thank you, and continued success to
thank
all
you.
Three of you.
Thank you very much.
Kieran, your work is vital, because you advise people and guide them along the journey, and well done for having the bottle. Sorry,
but
you having the bottle, you having the ingenuity and creativity with your food, and we look forward to your success. Martina Woods from Harry Treats, Kieran Comerford, Head of Enterprise and Carlow County Council, and Patrice Cooney. Barisalee are playing Barisacane in the North Tipperary final and the minor final. It's your one with the Tipperary jersey. That'll be Patrice. So you can meet her there.
Yeah.
Thank you all.
Thank
for
you very much.
Thank you very much.
Well, it's hard to believe, but it's 25 years, and indeed some have passed since our first glimpse of Riverdance. And so it makes sense that the original begetter of the project, Bill Whelan, is busily working on the Silver Anniversary album. Brian Lally, our colleague here, met the maestro in the place he feels most at home, his home, studio in Connemara.
My mother was delighted that after a rather torturous career in UCD, I eventually had a degree But she knew, like my father did as well, that there wasn't going to be much diverting of me away from music, which I had done since I was a child, at their bidding, by the way. Yeah. They had a lot, you know, my mother played piano. There were musical evenings where people came in and played. So I was surrounded by music. If you had aspirations towards a musical career, generally the route was through teaching, yeah. Which I didn't see that I wanted to do, or else at a very high level of performance, none of which I felt I could achieve. From an early age, I wanted to write, I wanted to create music, I wanted to be involved in the creation of music in some way, either as an orchestrator or arranger. I was always intrigued by the whole business of writing for large ensembles. And I was in a band, quite a well-known band in Dublin circles for a couple of years called Stack. Yeah. All the time I was getting more and more involved in production. I remember when my mother was very ill towards the end of her life, I finally had a record which was number one in the British charts, and that was Johnny Logan's What's Another Year, which I arranged and produced, Shahidi's great song. And
the saxophone solo is down to you.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I had been working in a band with that guy, Colin Tully, who was a Scottish player who played sax, and I said to him, would you come in and play on this record? And I wrote the intro exactly and the break in the middle. So I had a hit record, and I remember my mother, who was very ill, you know, at the time, and knew she was towards the end of her life, she turned to me and she said, you know, I think you're on your way now. Neither of my parents, and I often regret this, they never lived on to see all the other stuff that was to shape my musical life. I don't go around whistling tunes or any of that kind of thing. And generally my compositional activity, is quite concentrated. Yeah. I do a lot of preparation, a lot of avoiding. And then eventually I get down to it. Yeah. Generally speaking, I sit at the piano, yeah, and I play around with ideas. That's generally the way I write. Sometimes I'll have something going on in my head. Not so much melodic stuff, but rhythmic ideas and stuff. And then I sit down and they appear on the piano. I work best in the morning, and I generally have whatever I'm going to do in that day is going to be done by lunchtime. Living here has been really inspirational for me, and hence I've written quite a few pieces which are, I believe, come out of my head as a result of living in this environment. You know, I might write a piece, as I have done, let's say, in the Inishlakken suite, where I would write something about what the island turns out in Inishlakken mean to me. This environment can create in one day all kinds of different.
And it's
moments.
Not all smooth and gentle and pastoral and beautiful. It can be violent as well.
Violent and sometimes somber and even depressing. Yeah. Sometimes, you know, when you get one of those sort of missed days, yeah, for instance, like today, where we can't even see Inishnee, yeah, they come down on you and they connect to some other part of your, to the darker side of your being. And then you'll get those big high skies, those Paul Henry skies, yeah, and the fresh wind in off the sea that'll really kind of open up other parts of your consciousness. I'm currently mixing the new Riverdance album. Riverdance is 25 years old, and we're making an album at the moment, which we're now at the mixing stage of, which is using all those young, you know, exciting young players, people like Damian Milan, from who lives over in Spittle, who not alone are willing to extend the vocabulary of the music and to experiment with it, while still keeping a close eye on the tradition and remembering where they come from. If I hadn't done the Seville Suite in 1992 and had the Spanish connection in that, and if I hadn't done the Spirit of Mayo in 93, brought in the drumming and the choral, the Anuna and all that, Riverdance wouldn't have happened. Yeah. But I mean, there's the session in Ronstone now. What did that do for me? It introduced me to Seamus O'Flaherty now from Carna. And I saw his sister Quiva up here in Roundstone on Wednesday last, and she's dancing and she's playing the fiddle and she's Shannon singing. This is what's really, you know, hopeful and about the whole scene of Irish music. But it's the same as our political life. We wish it was more where we can respect the local, but also look out into the wider world. The instinct of music is to actually move across borders. We don't have to nail our colours to any particular mast and say, this is us. It's terrible to see music which wants to be free in the sense that it moves around freely and allows people to respond to it. That's its nature, I think, you know. And it's what we're seeing going on at the moment with the narrow nationalism that's appearing in the UK and in the US, that sort of insularity, which is, you know, which when I see this music is completely against all of that kind of thinking.
I love that. The thrilling Riverdance ending Brian Lally's chat with Bill Whelan, which also included bits of What's Another Year, Time Dance and the Connemara Suite. He's playing the Clifton Arts Festival with Colm McInerney next week. Details at www.cliftonartsfestival.ie. Always good to have Bill Whelan on the radio. Now, tomorrow afternoon, a stone border bridge between the villages of Belcoo in County Fermanagh and Blackline in Cavan will be closed to celebrate in a long table dinner on the bridge, the food and drink of the border region. Love the idea. Boxty Without Borders is the title of the event, and the food and drink is being provided by 24 food and farming suppliers in the area. Suzanne Campbell went up this week and she joins me now this morning here in studio. Good morning, Suzanne.
Good morning, Marty.
Tell me about the Boxty Without Borders. Well, it sounds lovely.
It's just a fantastic idea. It's a fantastic event to celebrate the food and drink of the North and the South. They're going to have 24 food and farming suppliers. Will I tell you a bit that's on the menu?
Do.
Short rib of beef, Fermanagh pork, smoked and cured fish, garden greens, heritage potatoes, Corleggy cheese from Cavan, Onya's chocolate from Cavan, Boatyard Distillery are providing drinks from Fermanagh, and of course Boxty. And it's really set up to tell a story of kind of cross-border communities who are producing away in the food sector, being very successful, and to highlight that. And it's set up by a group called the Irish Food Champions, which are 17 chefs, food producers, people in the fishing sector, people in food production and agriculture who are holding more events to tell more stories about Irish food. Now, one of these food champions is Geroige Lynch. He's a very well-known chef of a restaurant called the Old Post Inn, which is in Clover Hill, very near the border as well in Cavan. He's been central to putting together the event. And I took a walk with him along the bridge between Lochneen Upper and Lochneen Lower, and he told me what the event's going to look like at the day.
So if you see, Suzanne, the 50 kilometre speed sign there in Black Lion, and then we look to the right and we see the 30 mile speed sign into Belcoo. Mm-hmm. So our table is going to be in the centre. So we're going to have 150 people to sit down there for food and drink. But there's going to be 75 of them is going to be in the north and 75 of them is going to be in the south.
So the border is smack in the middle of those two signs.
Smack in the middle. Like, you see where the concrete starts to change colour there. So exactly in the middle is where the centre of the long table is going to be. So it's going to be a covered event. We're going to set up a marquee that's going to cover the bridge. Now,
okay.
We only have a couple of hours to get a marquee up. 2 hours, 3 hours to do food and drink and look after our guests. And then we have a couple of hours to take the whole marquee down and get the road reopened again. So it has been a logistical task to achieve what we've achieved
today. So you're closing the bridge between North and South and you're going to dine on it. It's such a fantastic idea, though.
I mean, I must pay tribute to, you know, the 17 food champions, as well as Laura Pepper, who was my restaurant manager, who kind of was very much behind the help in closing off the bridge. And obviously Fermanagh, Oma District Council and Cavan County Council, this idea came a couple of weeks ago. I mean, the willingness to get this over the line. And to be honest, if you had asked me 3 weeks ago, it probably was hitting a slight wall with logistical stuff that was coming against us. But I think on the day, Suzanne, I think it'll be worth it. I think to bring an all-island food together on a long table, bringing produce from the north, bringing produce for the south, and laying it out on the table here will be tremendous. And the help that local suppliers, farmers around us give us, people have just really come together to celebrate Irish food and the taste of the island on the day.
There's so much traffic there in the background. You can really hear the amount of journeys and trade taking place, can't you?
Absolutely. This is a busy border crossing, but it's one of about 300, Marty, along the border itself, which is 310 miles. It really is. I mean, with looking at what's happening in the Commons, it really is devastating to think the impact on these communities if Britain leaves with no deal. And here at Belcoo, you know, the villages, Belcoo and Backline, they're just about 200 metres apart. Boxty, of course, is the factor drawing the both together. And I talked to Portugal Gallagher from Leitrim, who's a brewer. He's the owner of the Boxty House restaurant in Dublin, and he's pretty much a Boxty expert. And I asked him about its importance of a food in this region.
Well, Boxty originated in Leitrim, Fermanagh, Cavan, Mayo. So this whole area is steeped in Boxty. From your boiled Boxty, your baked Boxty and your pan Boxty, the three types of Boxty. It's the bread. I did a thesis on it. It's the bread peculiar to this part of the country. And it's forgotten. When I was a kid growing up, we'd cross back and forward the border and all the shops would sell the boiled Boxty. You'd have the pan Boxty. It was a home-cooked product. It's all died out. There's only a few producers left now. You have Drumolly, you have McNiff's, and you have Drummond Boxty and Shannonside Boxty. There's a few of them left.
How did they differ from parish to parish, and why were those differences?
It's basically grated raw potato. Some houses will use mashed potato, especially for the dumplings. Some houses won't. Some houses will put milk. Some houses just use water out of it. Some houses will extract the starch out of it, separate the water off the starch, and have the starch back in. Listen, I've gone through hundreds and hundreds of recipes on this Boxty, and it's just a fascinating subject. William Carleton wrote about it. The first written evidence I found of Boxty was from 1828 in the Traits of the Irish Peasant, which is really, really important, because a lot of the cookery books you'll find, and if you look up Boxty, everybody said it was a famine dish. It couldn't have been a famine dish because we didn't have potatoes.
Yeah,
but it was especially a celebratory dish.
And are you cooking it tomorrow, or who's cooking it?
We'll be all cooking some tomorrow. It'll be all hands on deck.
And how many are you expecting?
150, and I think we're practically sold out, except for a few tickets maybe coming back.
Boxty Without Borders, the place to be. It's also a family food festival. And Suzanne Campbell, thank you very much indeed for joining us.